Okay, so one thing that a lot of us like to do is deal with data. And when you have data and you hopefully have a model that you think describes the data, then your typical thing is to try to ask the question of which model parameters best fit my data and what's the distribution of model parameters consistent with my data set. And so a technique that maybe, has anyone not used markup chain Monte Carlo? Maybe a few of the theorists, yeah, okay, good. So most of us have used it. And so, okay, so I'm gonna give a brief review though of standard markup chain Monte Carlo, which is to say that first you have to write down a likelihood function of your model parameters. And typically, this is the product of a prior on those parameters. So for example, there may be non-physical values of the parameters, or you may want, say, to make one of the parameters a log parameter, and then when you take the exponential of it, then you may want to multiply by a prior to make that log probability turn into a uniform probability. And then you multiply this by the probability of your model parameters given the data. Okay, so then once you have this likelihood function, then the, well, actually, let me give a specific example. So a common example is when you're fitting some data set in which you can compute the chi-squared of the data. So let me take a vector of data points given your set of model parameters, which I'll call x. This is a times, not an x there, actually. okay, so, and then the chi-squared will look like sum over your data set of your ith data point minus, actually I'm going to add a time vector here too, because frequently we're, and for exoplanets of course, and for astroseismology we're dealing with a time dependent data set. Then I have a model function that's a function of my parameters and the ith time step. And I'll take the square of that and then divide by the uncertainty in each data point, which is essentially a multidimensional Gaussian in which I've assumed that each data point is independent and has a standard deviation that we know in advance, sigma sub I. Okay, so that's, so a chi-squared is a kind of easy or typical case for this part, and then if we don't apply a prior, then this is our full likelihood. There can be other constant terms that you multiply this by, but I'm ignoring those for now. Yeah, Dan, I'm probably leaving something.
I always have a million things to say. Because it's a pet peeve of mine, I just want to correct the terminology here just a tiny bit.
Okay, sounds good.
The thing that you need for MCMC, which is the prior times the likelihood, is the posterior probability.
Great. Yeah.
And the likelihood is a probability of data given parameters, which is backwards from what you have written there.
Yeah. So I was skipping the steps in Bayes' theorem where you go from data given parameters to parameters given data, but yes, that's correct. So
it's very important that you can't, like, there's no such thing as using MCMC on a likelihood.
Great, thanks. Yeah.
Good. It seems annoying to say it, like, to be so picky about that, but
yeah, no, that's
it does have that matter.
That's good. Yeah. And I'm hoping Dan will chime in more than once in this talk. Okay, so then. What was that?
I was going to say, I understand the book on how many times Dan
chimes. Yeah, yeah. okay, so, all right, so then the next step is to choose some starting set of parameters for your, for the markup chain. And you can either, typically you want to draw that from your prior distribution, but frequently that will give you a very low likelihood. And so commonly you draw this near the best fit set of parameters that you found, say by optimizing your model initially. And okay, so then the Markov chain proceeds by then perturbing these. So this is your starting point. So you add this to your chain.
Can I ask just a meta question? Before
certainly.
Yeah. What's the point of MCMC? What are we hoping to achieve?
Oh, okay. Yes, that's a good question. So what we're hoping to achieve is to calculate the probability distribution of the model parameters given some data set that we've observed. So as Dan said, that's considered the posterior probability of that set of parameters. So the nice thing with this Markov chain Monte Carlo probability distribution is that once you've constructed your chain, then you can do various integrals over that distribution to calculate, say, the expectation value of a parameter given actually just a sum over all the parameters in your chain. You can calculate the standard deviation in that, or you can calculate, you know, or you can plot histograms to give you the probability distribution
of individual parameters. And is the advantage that you don't have to fully sample the whole of parameter space?
Exactly, yeah. So, right. And once your set of model parameters gets large, then it can be difficult to, say, lay down a grid if you have, say, 10 dimensions. And let's say you make a grid of 10 values in each parameter, then you have 10 to the 10th sets of models to compute. So so the procedure then kind of stays in the high probability region of parameter space and then gives you in that chain and kind of sample, hopefully, from that probability distribution of parameters given that data set.
So actually some theorems show that in the limit, appropriate limits, it does converge to the actual probability.
Yeah, as you go to infinity, actually. So one issue is how long do you have to run this Markov chain to get adequate sample of your probability distribution?
So at the very simplest level, it's a fast way to get out a probability distribution, a set of probability distribution functions for a high dimensional data set.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't invert the problem. Right. You can't get a solution trivially from the inversion and brute force it for it's a foreign model.
Dan, do you have anything to add to that? Good. Okay, so then once you have that starting point, now this is there's a lot of art that goes into this, but then you perturb the parameters and calculate a trial, the likelihood of a trial step, which is or posterior probability of the trial step. Thanks, Dan. Where this is equal to your previous step. Actually, I'll just call this I plus one. Well, no, this is still a trial, sorry. Take your previous step and then perturb the parameters a bit. So you're basically random, choosing a random direction in parameter space with which to select a new set of parameters to calculate the posterior probability at that new set of parameters. Okay, so there's a lot of art that goes into this. A lot of times this is a multidimensional Gaussian. Hopefully you know something about your model and your parameters so you can choose the size of the Gaussian and the different dimensions properly. There's a popular technique known as affine invariant Markov chain Monte Carlo, which many of you probably used. And Dan's written the widely used code for this. And what that does is it uses a whole population of points, and from that distribution of points takes basically the difference between sets of points in your chain or sets of your population and moves along the distance between those points along a line with the probability that's chosen to be to satisfy the constraints of the theorems that are prove markup chain Monte Carlo works. And then from that population, then you choose a trial step that tends to lie along your probability distribution, so it gives you a high probability of acceptance of the next step. So population techniques are popular for a reason, in that they are good at selecting a trial step from your distribution of chains, and you can run them in parallel and multi-cores. So then with this likelihood evaluated at trial step, you don't actually add this to your chain yet. You first check on the ratio of likelihoods of the trial step divided by the likelihood of the previous step. I keep saying likelihood, posterior probability distribution. So you check on the ratio of these, and you accept this step with the probability of 100% if this likelihood is better than this likelihood. So if you're improving your likelihood and going towards, you know, a higher likelihood region, then you always accept that. Or with, let's call this alpha, this ratio, or with probability alpha if it's less than, if the new point is a lower probability than the previous point. So if you choose your step size too large in parameter space, you know, moving through parameter space, then you can go into a very low probability region of parameter space, and you'll tend to reject these points. If your step size is too small, then you'll generally have a similar likelihood, so you'll have a high probability of acceptance. But with a high probability of acceptance, then you're not going to move very far in parameter space, and so it's going to take a long time to diffuse through parameter space. So generally, you want to tune your trial steps so that your acceptance probability is about 25% is a kind of rule of thumb. So okay, so now the problem comes in when you have a very large set of parameters, x, then as you're random walking through parameter space, perturbing these parameters, then it, you diffuse through parameter space. When the size of the parameter space is extremely large, it takes a long time to diffuse through that parameter space. And so a markup chain Monte Carlo is generally effective when you have, you know, say up to 15, 20 dimensions. It depends on the problem, of course. So if your probability distribution looks like a multi-dimensional Gaussian, and if you're sampling in that Gaussian, then of course you can do a much better job in choosing your step size, step both size and direction in parameter space. but if you have a complex probability distribution, then it can take a very long time to diffuse through that parameter space. So after running this markup chain for some time, then you have to check, you know, have I taken an adequate number of steps to really represent the probability distribution of parameters given the data in my priors? So there's various checks that can be done. Typically, you'll first plot each parameter, which will look like a random walk. And you can calculate the autocorrelation function of these parameters, which you do that for every parameter. And when your autocorrelation function drops below some level, then you know that you've gone far enough that you've essentially reached an independent sample in your parameter space for that particular parameter. And so there's various prescriptions for determining some some autocorrelation length And when you divide your total length by this autocorrelation length, that gives you an effective number of independent samples. And so typically, you know, the larger that number is, the better, because then you're getting a more precise probability distribution for each set of parameters. Okay, so the problem comes in then if you have a very high dimensional problem that you're sampling from, then a lot of times you'll get a Markov chain that will look like this. And when you end it, it's, you know, hasn't even reached one independent sample. And, you know, if you were to run this for a lot longer, it might start to look like this. But if you're if your probability distribution is very hard to compute, your model is hard to compute, then that can, you know, take a really long time to do. Yeah.
If we can go back to the autocorrelation for a second. I've used tools that do something like they calculate this autocorrelation length, and then you keep approximately 1 point per autocorrelation time.
Yeah.
Could you comment on why you might or might not do that? To me, neither approach.
Okay, yeah. So the question is, do you discard the points that are correlated? In principle, you can, and this is called thinning the chains. If they're, you know, if you run it for many millions of steps, then you may want and may not want to store every single one of those steps if they're correlated. I have heard, this is secondhand, that it does improve your posterior probability distribution calculation if you keep every step, even if they're correlated. But thinning should be fine as long as you're not thinning in greater than the autocorrelation length.
So I would just add to that the one catch is that there's a different autocorrelation for any combination of the parameters. So if you're some user of the results of an MCMC, you might care about some different combination of parameters that might have a shorter autocorrelation length. And so then it would be useful to you to have all of the samples rather than the thin samples. So that's why it can be tricky sometimes. There isn't just one autocorrelation length for sampling. It depends on what your objective is.
If you can, it's best to retain all the samples in the chain. I usually do that. Any other questions? Okay, so one way to get around this issue of in high dimensions, having your chain take a long time to explore parameter space and diffuse around each parameter, is to make your step sizes much larger by basically adding parameters to your model, which sounds like it would make things worse, okay? And so the principle is actually based on Hamiltonian mechanics, and so it's called Hamiltonian Markov chain Monte Carlo, although it's usually abbreviated HMC. It's also sometimes referred to as hybrid Markov chain Monte Carlo, so it still is an HMC. And the basic idea then is to treat your minus log likelihood, and I'm going to keep saying likelihood, sorry Dan, minus log probability as a potential energy.
Eric, I'm imagining there's a stack of your papers on Dan's desk.
Yeah, right. Yeah, probably. Okay, so in so now our likelihood then is equal to proportional to e to the minus. You can actually add constants to this as well. I'll just say equal. So it's e to the minus u, which looks a lot like a thermodynamic probability distribution. So now what we're going to do is add to this potential energy a kinetic energy term. And that will be a function of momentum variables. It'll be a quadratic function, or typically it's a quadratic function. And with a quadratic function for the kinetic energy, it's easy to draw samples from this momentum distribution. And so because it's easier to sample from, then that will prove critical in using this to actually accelerate the exploration of parameter space. Okay, so what does this look like? Well, the kinetic energy is a function of momentum variables. These are artificial momenta, it's not literal momenta, is 1/2 times your momentum vector, and then you can add in a mass matrix times the momentum. And so if this were, if this mass matrix was diagonal, then each element of that diagonal would be the mass of the ith value. And so you can write this as I equals 1 to number of parameters, 1/2 EI squared divided by M sub I. So that looks like a kinetic energy term. In practice, you can add off-diagonal terms to this matrix to help improve your exploration of parameter space by using the correlations between the parameters to kind of make this momentum variable move you along valleys of in parameter space.
It doesn't have to be synthetic. In the Tropolis-Hastings algorithm, basically, you can use a real physical
yes.
Newtonian. This is the basis for all of that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
So does changing the off-diagonal terms work better than trying to change the variables so that they're not correlated, or?
That always helps. So the problem is if you set your mass matrix, say, at the optimum, the maximum likelihood in parameter space, then once you've moved off of that maximum likelihood, the correlations will change. So there is a technique that can actually adapt this mass matrix to the local area of parameter space. It's called Riemannian markup chain Monte Carlo, and it comes from Riemann spaces. But that actually requires higher order derivatives of your model, so that's complicated. Yes, so if you do have a set of parameters which is highly curved in probability space, if the probability distribution is highly curved with those respect to those parameters, it can help to transform to a more linear set of parameters. Of course, that effectively modifies your prior, so sometimes you need to correct that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to a related point later. Okay, so now, if we write out then our Hamiltonian as a function of x and p, then this is equal to p transpose mass inverse p plus, actually, I'm going to write this minus, well, okay, so I'm going to take the chi-squared example for specificity. So this is going to be plus 1/2 sigma or sum I equals 1 to n of the I data point minus my model. A function of the model parameters, assume there's time, and then the data point squared divided by sigma I squared. Okay, so now the idea is then when you're taking these trial steps, instead of just choosing perturbation in X and evaluating the trial step, what you can actually do is integrate the Hamilton's equations such that you move along regions in parameter space that are constant energy. Now, this is an augmented parameter space, so it has both the momentum, the kinetic energy and the potential energy. And so you can trade off between kinetic and potential energy, which gives you the ability to move up and down the potential energy term in parameter space and, in principle, move farther in parameter space than you would if you just use a potential energy term. So by adding this kinetic energy, it gives you the momentum, allows you to, in principle, take longer steps in parameter space and get over local bumps and wiggles within your likelihood probability distribution function. So now this is a problem though. because in order to calculate Hamilton's equations, you need to be able to take the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to your set of model parameters. So Hamilton's equations then become, let me actually write this, the ith component of, I'll use jth actually. Now time is not this time. This is the artificial time for Hamilton's equations, and I'll come back to that in a second. Okay, so now the kinetic energy depends on the momentum, and the potential energy depends on the coordinates, which now are model parameters, not literal coordinates. So the h, the x of I, so Hamilton's equation for the momentum terms, sorry, this should be j. I'm going to try and keep those separate, will just depend on the potential energy term. So this is equal to minus du dxj. And then you can write this, in this case, as derivative of, now I'm going to write this as a model vector in terms of the ith components, dxj with respect to the jth component of the model parameters. And then I'm now going to generalize this 1 over sigma I squared to a covariance matrix inverse. And in this example, the covariance matrix just has 1 over sigma I squared entered on the diagonal, dotted with the data minus the model vector. And hopefully I got the signs of this right. Yeah, there's a minus sign here which cancels with that sign. And the 1/2, this is, because this is squared, the 2 cancels the 1/2 there. Okay, so now this means that I need to be able to calculate the derivatives of my model with respect to the model parameters. And so that can be difficult. So let's say you're trying, you know, to fit a stellar model to some data set. Then you need the derivatives of the properties of that stellar model at an observed time with respect to the initial conditions of the stellar evolution model. So that could be challenging. Okay, so one solution that if I have time, hopefully I'll get it, just show an example of, is something called automatic differentiation. And this is a computational technique which basically the AutoDiff libraries take your code and parse it step by step within the code into, you know, what at the machine level is a fairly simple function. So everything that you're doing in your code typically is addition, subtraction, division, multiplication, etc. All those we know how to differentiate, and so the AutoDiff libraries will do that for you on a step-by-step basis. And then they'll apply the chain rule to your code and give you the derivatives of the output of your code, or the Jacobian of the output of your code with respect to the input parameters in principle.
Has that been done to Mesa? That would be interesting.
Sorry, what was that?
Has that been tried with Mesa?
Oh, yeah, I thought about that actually.
I don't know. Even micro, no,
just another module. Yeah. Yeah, so no, that's a really good question. I don't know. Does anyone know the answer to that?
I imagine it would be kind of tricky.
Yeah.
Mesa's got a nonlinear Newton solver.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And right. I'm not sure how well iterative algorithms.
So, yeah. So that actually we can do. Yeah. Yeah. But how do you handle conditionals? So that actually is okay too. You can propagate derivatives through conditions as well. Because the only thing that you need, so the key point here is it's not getting the symbolic derivative, it's getting the derivative evaluated at a current point in parameter space. So derivatives of conditionals are just fine.
Yeah. Okay. And as long as you're not sort of
exactly. Yeah. But that's a set of measure zero, and so yeah, everything's okay. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the thing to mention, it sounds insane, right? Like that this exists at all. But it works really well. And the reason why is because this is sort of the foundation of all of machine learning. It relies on automatic differentiation. So there's been a huge amount of research into how to implement this in a back propagation or chain rule or they're all lots of different names for the same thing. But it actually is ridiculous. I mean, it's a lot of the, with a lot of code, it's just as efficient as going through and actually working through all the derivatives yourself. The code that it produces is really, really, really very good.
And it's better than doing finite difference derivatives because then you have to run your model for every single parameter to calculate its finite difference. And you can be subject to round-off error, which will give you really bad estimates of the derivatives. So often this works really extremely well. I have had cases where I've used automatic differentiation on a problem in which it turned out that two terms in the actual chain rule end up canceling exactly, and so I got significant round-off error. So if you do have analytic derivatives that are well, that you can calculate and are conditioned well numerically, that can be better, especially if they're efficient to evaluate. But in general, this works extremely well for simple functions. Okay, so now, and then the other set of Hamilton's equations you need are the derivatives with respect to the jth parameter, which is just equal to inverse of the mass matrix times the momentum, and then you take the jth component of that vector from the kinetic energy term. Okay, so.
So just to try to understand, you haven't said what the moments are yet.
No, I haven't, so yes, yeah.
So they're implicitly defined by this equation for dPdA by this.
Yeah, so they are defined by this equation, yeah. They're defined by Hamilton's equations, actually.
Which is to give you completely in terms of the model.
Right, exactly.
For the mass matrix, you have to assign some power.
You have to assign, yeah. And that can take some art, it turns out. But yeah, that's one issue with this. So a lot of times, you can just take this to be the identity matrix, but sometimes it helps to weight each of the momentum terms by a different value, and sometimes it can help to have off-diagonal terms to take into account correlations between parameters.
So it feels a little bit like the regularization you do in inversion.
Did I say that again, sir?
The way you regularize inverse analysis by adding terms to the chi-squared, basically.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So
it's not that exactly the same, but it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. So you, and in principle, if you wanted to add regularization to your probability distribution, I think that could work. Yeah. So one common choice for the mass matrix is to compute the Hessian at the maximum likelihood, and I actually can't remember if it's the inverse of the Hessian or the Hessian that get used as the mass matrix, and then that ends up accounting for the correlations between parameters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tim?
Is there a simple way to understand what the momentum and the mass terms are? Like, for example, if I fit a straight line to points, the simplest possible thing, what do they turn out to be?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So if I have a two-dimensional parameter space, I don't have a full answer to that, so let's say I have x1 and x2 are my two model parameters, like the example of fitting a line to data, then there'll be some likelihood distribution in parameter space that will be correlated. And then the momenta terms, you can think of, well, let's see. So
it's memory.
Say that again.
It's memory.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
Keeping the points, isn't it keeping the chain going in the same direction, generally? Inertia.
Yes, it is inertia. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good that's a good way to put it. So the momentum terms then, of course, you're adding to, I can't draw four dimensions, but you're adding two extra dimensions to this. The next step that I'm about to get to is that you'll integrate Hamilton's equations, usually with like a leapfrog integrator, and what that will do is it will cause you to orbit in this parameter space. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not so constant energy orbit.
Yeah, and it's constant energy orbit, yeah. So that allows you to go a further distance by giving it some kinetic energy. You can go uphill in your potential energy and then come back downhill. And so it's that inertial term from the momentum that allows you to do that within this parameter space. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah. A little bit, yeah.
Maybe
it's useful. So in fitting a line, your posterior would be exactly Gaussian, and so then the mass matrix would be, so the optimal mass matrix would be the inverse of the covariance of that Gaussian. So you can think of that as like, you know, you want less mass in the directions where you have to move far, and more mass in the directions where you shouldn't move as much, so that if you give it a kick, it'll move in the directions that you want.
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of constraining the chain or the walk.
Yeah, exactly. You're telling it to go further in the parameters that are less well constrained.
Okay, so then, so the next is to start to do this orbit within parameter space. And commonly what's used for Hamiltonian Markov-Chain Monte Carlo is to do a leapfrog integration. So that's a symplectic integration in which you alternate between the kinetic energy and the potential energy terms. And the nice thing about symplectic integrators is that they conserve volumes in phase space. And I'll get to this in a couple steps, but at some point in our numerical integration, the energy won't be exactly conserved because it's, because we're taking finite steps, and so there's an error term associated with that. And so at the end of the orbit integration, we will accept or reject the step with the same probability likelihood ratio that you use in a standard Hamiltonian Markov chain Monte Carlo. So when you do that acceptance or rejection, you also have to include a volume ratio term, but in the symplectic integration case, that volume term cancels out. So I'll just say that the symplectic integrator is useful for doing this.
When you do the accept or reject, are you using the original posterior or the one that's sort of modified to happen?
The modified one, yeah. Yeah, so we're using the full Hamiltonian. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's okay. Why it's awesome, because if you conserve energy, then your acceptance probability is always one.
Right. but that would require taking very tiny steps, which is then inefficient because you have to compute the derivatives at each of those steps. That's exactly right.
That's the pitch, anyways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. okay. So then, what do you choose for the momentum? In the diagonal case of the diagonal mass matrix, then you just select the momentum from a normal distribution, the zero mean, and the covariance that's given by your mass matrix. Okay. Okay, so then once you've selected a momentum, which you do at every single step, then you want to integrate in this expanded parameter space. and the leapfrog integrator means that you have to choose a time step. And I'm following notation from a paper by Neil, which I'll do the reference for. We'll call this epsilon. And what you need to do is actually tune the value of epsilon. So this is not always automatically given. So can be a source of frustration for implementing Hamiltonian Markov chain Monte Carlo. And the basic point is that if your time steps are too large, then you won't conserve energy very well. And so then when you do at the end of your integration, accept or reject the step, if your energy is not conserved very well, generally there's more parameter space has a lower likelihood, so you'll end up rejecting more steps if your epsilon is too large, typically, because your orbital integration won't match the exact orbit. if your epsilon is too small, then you spend a lot of time computing your model and its derivatives, and so then it just gets more computationally expensive. So typically you want to tune epsilon Oh, and then there's another parameter, which I'll call L, which is the number of steps in your integration. Okay, so that then, so you choose some momentum, you integrate, well, I haven't written down the leapfrog integrator yet, but you integrate this orbit, and at each step you have to recompute the derivatives and alternate Hamilton's equations. So if you choose too many steps in your orbit, then your orbit will just continue to oscillate around the likelihood distribution, and you'll come back to where you close to where you originally were, and so it can be wasteful to take too many steps. So you have to tune L as well to be long enough that you'll get to a fairly new region of parameter space, but not so long that you'll start wrapping around in parameter space. So that there's the fact that you have kind of three tunable things now can make Hamiltonian markup chain Monte Carlo somewhat frustrating. Fortunately, there are packages and algorithms that allow you to tune these parameters somewhat in an automated fashion. Okay, so with this momentum, now you can do a leapfrog integration where the jth value of the momentum at the current time step plus half of your epsilon time step is equal to the value at the start of that time step minus epsilon over 2, because I'm taking half a step for the leapfrog, du dxi. And then I'll do the same in leapfrog integrator. Then you take a full epsilon for the position, and that's going to be your initial position plus your momentum times the time step. And I'm just assuming a diagonal mass matrix. So this is the, I keep switching. I'm trying to keep this in terms of J so that my chi-squared has an I summation. Okay, and then the second, the last part of the leapfrog integrator is to do the last half of the momentum step. Okay, so now when you're doing multiple steps, so you basically, now I'm going to have k equals 1 to L. These two steps, you need this gradient, but you can combine these into a single step. So in the intermediate steps, you only need to do two components. How am I doing on time, by the way? This is...
You're 45 minutes in.
Okay, great. Okay, so at the end of this integration, then you do three is to accept or reject. And I should have said before that if you reject a trial step, then you copy your current position in the chain. You make a copy of that and add that to your chain so that regions with high probability where you, no matter what direction you go, you tend to go to lower regions and lower probability regions in parameter space, those will be emphasized in your final posterior probability distribution. So you use the standard algorithm, but now you use the full Hamiltonian rather than just the potential energy term. Okay, so typically, you want to tune epsilon and L to give an acceptance rate of about 60%. So it's higher than, now in principle, it should be 100% if your energy was conserved perfectly, but it never is. And you know, if your energy is conserved too perfectly, that means you have to take really small values of time step. The error in the symplectic, and the leapfrog integrator scales like epsilon squared, so the smaller epsilon, you can get more precise energy conservation, but then you're spending a lot of time computing these derivatives of your model with respect to the model parameters.
Would there be any advantage to using something higher order than LeapFrog?
From what I've been read, no. So LeapFrog, I think, is efficient enough generally.
So this is independent of the number of model parameters, right?
Which is, sorry, say that again?
The tuning that you do for epsilon.
Yes, it is, yeah. And one of the the touted advantages of Hamiltonian market chain Monte Carlo, this doesn't always work, but one of the principal advantages is that the exploration of parameter space scales better with the number of free parameters because of this momentum term. Then you can zoom around in your probability space without diffusing. So now, again, if your epsilon were too small and your L were too small, then you would go back to diffusing through parameter space. If they're too large, then you're spending way too much time doing these orbit integrations, and you're spending a lot of time. So, yeah, so epsilon and L, you end up tuning. If you tune them to the 60% value, I'm told, that will sort of optimize your computational expense. Okay, so all right, so the last few minutes, I want to try and share some examples.
So while you're getting set up, I might just mention that in practice, it's rare that people actually use vanilla HMC because there are so many tuning parameters. Mm-hmm. So people would generally use something called the no U-turn sampler, which is a sort of fancy way of setting L automatically. And that's the most tricky one in general. And so that's the algorithm that is generally, when people refer to Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, they often mean no U-turn.
And no U-turn is presumably, it doesn't start doing orbits.
Exactly,
It has some heuristic for trying to figure out where it's turning around and stopping there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's tricky to prove detailed balance and to actually get a sampler that converges, but there's a really nice paper that goes through the math to demonstrate it.
Okay, so Dan shared with me this video, which I'm blocking. Okay. So this is a very simple case. Q is x, and so that's the coordinate, or the model parameter. In this case, the potential energy is just a quadratic, so it's a one-dimensional Gaussian. So this, of course, you wouldn't need Hamiltonian market chain Monte Carlo for. And then the vertical axis is the momentum on the bottom plot. And so then the idea is that if you draw randomly a momentum at your current position, then basically you're going to jump from one momentum to another, and then you'll do the integration in the Q and P coordinates for some number of steps, and then you'll accept or reject. And if you accept, then you add that to your histogram at the top for the coordinate. And so you can see, it's going up and down this potential, and then these orbits in position and momentum space, in this case, are just ovals. And you can see at the end of each integration, you're at the same coordinate, but you jump to a different momentum. So in multiple dimensions, then, of course, you're choosing a multidimensional momentum chain.
Would you ever keep the intermediate points from the integration as part of the chain, or would that?
In principle, you could, yeah. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it'll approach a Gaussian distribution.
It's not real time, this video.
Slow down. Yeah.
So I'm sorry, momentum are randomly chosen?
Yes, they're drawn from a multidimensional Gaussian distribution based upon the covariance matrix for the momentum, which is the mass matrix.
So. Right. So that's all that. So you sort of have to know the characteristics of your solution too, and that could easily.
In principle, yes.
Finding the absolute minimum. And so I can see where this could get stuck, in these orbits.
Yes, so that is an issue with Hamiltonian Markov chain Monte Carlo. It doesn't always work very well if you have a highly multimodal distribution, and if you're stuck in some local minimum. In principle, it should be able to get out of that local minimum and find the global minimum. I'm now talking about for the potential energy term. In practice, that doesn't always work perfectly, especially if your multimodal distributions are well separated by very low probability distributions.
I guess, you know, I was thinking about the problem where you do are near the absolute minimum, the global minimum, but because you don't know what that shape is like, you could just spend all the time orbiting.
Yes, and so you need to tune the number of steps that you take.
Another key point is that is MCMC is not trying to find the minimum, like explicitly.
Right.
So
yeah,
it's
that's right.
Actually trying to sample. It will never, I mean, in a high dimensional problem, it'll never be close to the optimum. And so that's why.
No,
in a high dimensional space, there's so much volume that's
that dominates
away,
the probability.
The typical set is so far from the optimum that you'll never be close to it. And so if you want to find the optimum, then you should use an optimizer.
Yeah.
But
it helps to have derivatives for an optimizer.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it is this key point that that you'll notice in that. Even in 1D, you know, it's always, you know, and it looks like it's close to the optimum in the 1D projection, but in 2D, it's never close to the center.
Yeah.
So when that little dot was moving around, the time it took, so it always jumped vertically, so it jumped to a new momentum vertically.
Yeah.
But the time it took to do that varied. Is that because there was some rejections on some paths that just kept going for a bit longer?
Depends on the momentum value, so yeah.
Actually, in this case, if you're using vanilla HMC, it's recommended that you randomly assign L each step.
Oh, yeah,
step.
Right. Yeah.
So it's using a different L, so a different number of leapfrog steps in every integration.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And that helps you so that you're not always going to be in the worst case scenario.
Because you might get sort of resonance.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so
you can see.
That's why it's being up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So that I was going to try and live code this, but I don't think so. I'll just lead you through this Jupyter notebook, in which I do a simple HMC calculation. So I define a potential energy function. I define a kinetic energy function. In this case, it's just the 1D case, and then the derivative of the potential energy. In this case, the gradient is just the derivative with respect to my single model parameter. I'll randomly select a value for that parameter as a starting point. And then I'll do, in this case, 10,000 integrations. I'm going to store the coordinates. So I have the position, the momentum, and the Hamiltonian. So I'm going to store that into three coordinates equal to the number of generations or integrations I'm doing. And then I'll set a fiducial number of steps, which I'm going to vary between 80% and 100% of this value due to what Dan just said. And then I'll set a time step. I'm actually going to vary this as well, but the fiducial value is 0.1. Okay, so now to start this Markov chain process, I set my initial coordinate equal to this initial step, or initial value. And then I loop over the number of integrations that I'm going to do. And then at each step, I'm choosing a random momentum from a normal distribution, the n. And then I'm also, in this version, I'm choosing my time step to be my fiducial time step times the absolute value of a Gaussian random number. So that's to actually vary the time step. I don't know if you do that too. And then my number of steps in the integration, I'm going to choose from my fiducial step times a uniform probability between 80 and 100% of that value. Okay, so for that initial x and p value, I compute my Hamiltonian as the sum of the kinetic energy and the potential energy terms. I'm actually going to add that initial step to my chain, just putting together the position, the momentum, and the Hamiltonian. And then now I'm going to do the leapfrog integration by defining some new coordinates, p nu and x nu, for which the first step requires the gradient of the potential energy with respect to that position. So I'll use that function that I defined above, which was just equal to x in this case because I'm using a Gaussian.
Is it just customary to use a unit normal momentum? Or is that by
that was just, yeah, so it's not, so the, so if you use a mass matrix, then you draw that from that multidimensional Gaussian, yeah. Okay, so then my first step in the leapfrog integration is to update my momentum term by taking half the time step, the epsilon over 2, times the gradient of this potential energy, with the gradient of the Hamiltonian with respect to the coordinates. And then I'll loop through the intermediate leapfrog time steps, updating the position based on my current momentum. Then I have to calculate that gradient again. This is always the expensive step. And then I update my momentum. And now I'm concatenating those two momentum updates into one. So I'm going to do that over epsilon. Because of that concatenation at the very end of the integration, notice that there's a minus sign in Hamilton's equations. I've actually overshot my time step, so I have to go backwards. And so that requires reversing that half final step. And then I compute the Hamiltonian at the end of that integration, and then take the probability ratio of the old Hamiltonian to the new one. And then I choose a random number between 0 and 1. If that's less than alpha, then I accept that step. And so my new set of coordinates, H, X, P, and Hamiltonian, are going to be the new value. If I reject it, then I just keep at my current step. And then when I add that to my chain up here, I'm just going to add a copy of the previous step. So, all right, let's see if this runs. okay, so the slow thing here actually is that I'm using Julia, which calls matplotlib, and it's Python, which is slow, typically. okay, that's done with that. Okay, so now I'll loop over 1,000 generations, which or 10,000, should be quick because everything's a simple function. Okay, that's done. So now I have the full 10,000 chains that have been integrated ever. I'm going to plot the momentum term, sorry, the position term, which is the first in this. And you can see that this is doing a really good job of sampling from that Gaussian distribution. And then here's the momentum term. That's also, that's drawn from a normal distribution, so it has to be normal. And also plot the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian is, in this case, you know, drawn from double Gaussian in momentum and position. And in this case, the minimum is zero. So you can see that that distribution looks like kind of the absolute value of a Gaussian distribution. Okay, so that's a simple, so you can write a simple Hamiltonian markup chain Monte Carlo in like 30 lines of code, minus the comments. but in practice, tuning the parameters of it can be complicated. So the no interim sampler that Dan mentioned can really speed things up when you have, especially when you have a lot of parameters, and setting that number of integrations can be really complicated.
Is the normal distribution draw, is that optimal in terms of if it's a locally quadratic?
Yeah, so if you're, if it's depends, you know, so if you define your momentum, your kinetic energy term as a multidimensional Gaussian, which is the standard, then that's optimal, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, so it's optimal if your posterior is a Gaussian.
Yeah.
You're talking about you're talking about the potential energy?
Yeah, so if the potential energy is quadratic in the parameters, then having a quadratic for the momentum will be optimal. Yeah. And the optimal covariance would be the inverse of each other.
Yeah.
I think it is interesting to think of if you have a more complicated potential energy, you could probably do better with, you know, something more complicated in the kinetic energy term.
Yeah, which is what Riemannian Hamiltonian markup chain Monte Carlo does, is it adapts the mass matrix to your coordinates. So your mass matrix is now a function of the local coordinates. And if you work through Hamilton's equations, then now your, no, it's behind the board, but your derivative of your Hamiltonian with respect to these coordinates, now you have to take the derivative of your mass matrix. The mass matrix is actually based on the Hessian of the local, of the current set of coordinates, which is a second order derivative. And so when you take Hamilton's equations, you need third order derivatives. If you have a lot of parameters, then that's a lot of derivatives to calculate. So in principle, you could use autodiff to do that. But in practice, the that would be optimum, is to adapt your local momentum distribution to your local Hessian. But in practice, it turns out to be better to use NUTS. No U-turn sampler is abbreviated NUTS. Yeah. Let's see. If anyone wants, I think we're past noon, so feel free to move on if you'd like. I did have another example. So a commonly used test for Markov chain Monte Carlo is something called the Rosenbrock function, which is a kind of very narrow valley that's strongly nonlinearly correlated. And so I've written a Markov chain sampler that that samples from the Rosenbrock function. So if this, okay, so let's see. Let me restart this, sorry. So what I'm going to show, hopefully, is the leapfrog integrations in this more complicated distribution. I'm just going to show the two coordinates. The Rosenbrock function has two, it's just a function of two coordinates. Okay, so each of these little colored paths is one of these integrations. And I'm actually not printing, plotting all of them. The Rosenbrock function has this really...
the horseshoe valley.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And it's asymmetric, yeah. So it's moving up and down this probability distribution valley. And now it's finished running. Okay, so... again, I think in this case I'm only plotting every 100th integration, so there's 100 times as many that were done in that short period of time. In this case, I actually adapted the mass matrix to the Hessian at the optimum set of values. This shows the distribution of the two model parameters in this case, x1 and x2. This shows a plot of the posterior distribution along with the 1 and 2 sigma confidence regions of the Rosenbrock function, so the red and green. And so you can see it's filling that in nicely. And then I'll plot the one-dimensional histograms of those parameters. So the orange is the analytic function, and then the blue is a histogram of the first parameter and the second parameter. And you can see that... it's doing pretty well in this case in reproducing the probability distributions of the Rosenbrock function. So I think I'll stop there. I do have a photodynamics example, photometry example too, I can show if anyone's interested.
I have a question. So, yeah. Like, I understand if something with the, like, let's say you're on step 0, mm-hmm. if that were accepted, that then when you integrate in the orbit, the other thing is very likely to be accepted because it has the same value of the Hamiltonian, and that's what you're using. But I don't understand why the first choice necessarily should be accepted. I'm sure there's some property of that that makes that, but if you just like added some function of your parameters to your, I don't know if it's likelihood or what, then that could. Yeah. Why? What property of this makes that?
Well, so you do want to throw away your initial samples for burn-in, just like a standard Markov chain Monte Carlo, so that you're not don't have a memory of where you initially started if it was a really low region, a probability region of parameter space. But the integrations, in practice, because you're trading off between this momentum and kinetic energy term, you typically will move towards the higher probability regions of your parameter space when you do this integration. And I'm talking about now the potential energy term. So, no matter where you start, you end up quickly moving to the high probability region of parameter space. You still do have to throw away the burn-in, but a lot of times the burn-in is very quick because the Hamiltonian markup chain in Monte Carlo is so efficient in moving through parameter space. I don't know if that answers your question.
So that's helpful. And then also, as you were explaining it, I realized what I was misconceptualizing, which is like since you're randomly selecting momentum, you're still in the same spot in X1 and X2. So you're never.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But you don't go the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Okay. Should we wrap it up?
Yes.